It was almost dark. He turned sharply, took a package of cigarettes from his pocket, pulled out one cigarette, but stopped, remembering her presence, as if he had forgotten it for a moment, and extended the package to her. She took a cigarette, and he struck the brief flare of a match, then shook it out, leaving only two small points of fire in the darkness of a glass room and of miles of mountains beyond it. She rose, paid her bill, and said, "Thank you, Dr. Axton. I will not molest you with tricks or pleas. I will not hire detectives. But I think I should tell you that I will not give up. I must find the inventor of that motor. I will find him. Not until the day when he chooses to find you. As he will." When she walked to her car, he switched on the lights in the diner. She saw the mailbox by the side of the road and noted the incredible fact that the name Hugh Axton stood written openly across it. She had driven far down the winding road, and the lights of the diner were long since out of sight, when she noticed that she was enjoying the taste of the cigarette he had given her. It was different from any she had ever smoked before. She held the small remnant to the light of the dashboard, looking for the name of the brand. There was no name, only a trademark. Stamped in gold on the thin white paper, there stood the sign of the dollar. She examined it curiously. She had never heard of that brand before. Then she remembered the old man at the cigar stand of the Taggart Terminal and smiled, thinking that this was a specimen for his collection. She stamped out the fire and dropped the butt into her handbag. Train number 57 was lined along the track, ready to leave for Wyatt Junction when she reached Cheyenne, left her car at the garage where she had rented it, and walked out on the platform of the Taggart station. She had half an hour to wait for the eastbound mainliner to New York. She walked to the end of the platform and leaned wearily against a lamppost. She did not want to be seen and recognized by the station employees. She did not want to talk to anyone. She needed rest. A few people stood in clusters on the half-deserted platform. Animated conversation seemed to be going on, and newspapers were more prominently in evidence than usual. She looked at the lighted windows of train number 57, for a moment's relief in the sight of a victorious achievement. Train number 57 was about to start down the track of the John Galt line, through the towns, through the curves of the mountains, past the green signals where people had stood cheering, and the valleys where rockets had risen to the summer sky. Twisted remnants of leaves now hung on the branches beyond the train's roofline, and the passengers wore furs and mufflers as they climbed aboard. They moved with the casual manner of a daily event, with the security of expecting a performance long since taken for granted. "We've done it," she thought. "This much, at least, is done." It was the chance conversation of two men somewhere behind her that came beating suddenly against her closed attention. "But laws shouldn't be passed that way, so quickly. They're not laws, they're directives." "Then it's illegal." "It's not illegal, because the legislature passed a law last month giving him the power to issue directives." "I don't think directives should be sprung on people that way, out of the blue, like a punch in the nose." "Well, there's no time to palaver when it's a national emergency." "But I don't think it's right, and it doesn't jive. How is Reardon going to do it when it says here?" "Why should you worry about Reardon? He's rich enough. He can find a way to do anything." Then she leaped to the first newsstand in sight and seized a copy of the evening paper. It was on the front page. Wesley Mooch, top coordinator of the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, "in a surprise move," said the paper, "and in the name of the national emergency," had issued a set of directives, which were strung in a column down the page. The railroads of the country were ordered to reduce the maximum speed of all trains to 60 miles per hour, to reduce the maximum length of all trains to 60 cars, and to run the same number of trains in every state of a zone composed of 5 neighboring states, the country being divided into such zones for the purpose. The steel mills of the country were ordered to limit the maximum production of any metal alloy to an amount equal to the production of other metal alloys by other mills placed in the same classification of plant capacity, and to supply a fair share of any metal alloy to all consumers who might desire to obtain it. All the manufacturing establishments of the country, of any size and nature, were forbidden to move from their present locations, except when granted a special permission to do so by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. To compensate the railroads of the country for the extra costs involved and to cushion the process of readjustment, a moratorium on payments of interest and principal on all railroad bonds, secured and unsecured, convertible and non-convertible, was declared for a period of 5 years. To provide the funds for the personnel to enforce these directives, a special tax was imposed on the state of Colorado, as the state best able to assist the needier states to bear the brunt of the national emergency. Such tax to consist of 5% of the gross sales of Colorado's industrial concerns. The cry she uttered was one she had never permitted herself before, because she made it her pride always to answer it herself. But she saw a man standing a few steps away. She did not see that he was a ragged bum, and she uttered the cry because it was the plea of reason, and he was a human figure. "What are we going to do?" The bum grinned mirthlessly and shrugged.
"Who is John Galt?"
It was not Taggart Transcontinental that stood as the focus of terror in her mind. It was not the thought of Hank Reardon, tied to a rack, pulled in opposite directions. It was Ellis Wyatt. Wiping out the rest, filling her consciousness, leaving no room for words, no time for wonder, as a glaring answer to the questions she had not begun to ask, stood two pictures. Ellis Wyatt's implacable figure in front of her desk, saying, "It is now in your power to destroy me. I may have to go, but if I go, I'll make sure that I take all the rest of you along with me." And the circling violence of Ellis Wyatt's body when he flung a glass to shatter against the wall. The only consciousness the pictures left her was the feeling of the approach of some unthinkable disaster, and the feeling that she had to outrun it. She had to reach Ellis Wyatt and stop him. She did not know what it was that she had to prevent. She knew only that she had to stop him. And because, were she lying crushed under the ruins of a building, were she torn by the bomb of an air raid, so long as she was still in existence, she would know that action is man's foremost obligation, regardless of anything he feels. She was able to run down the platform and to see the face of the station master when she found him. She was able to order, "Hold number 57 for me," then to run to the privacy of a telephone booth in the darkness beyond the end of the platform, and to give the long-distance operator the number of Ellis Wyatt's house. She stood, propped up by the walls of the booth, her eyes closed, and listened to the dead whirl of metal which was the sound of a bell ringing somewhere. It brought no answer. The bell kept coming in sudden spasms, like a drill going through her ear, through her body. She clutched the receiver as if unheeded. It were still a form of contact. She wished the bell were louder. She forgot that the sound she heard was not the one ringing in his house. She did not know that she was screaming, "Ellis, don't, until she heard the cold, reproving voice of the operator say, "Your party does not answer." She sat at the window of a coach of train number 57 and listened to the clicking of the wheels on the rails of Reardon metal. She sat unresisting, swaying with the motion of the train. The black luster of the window hid the countryside she did not want to see. It was her second run on the John Galt line, and she tried not to think of the first. The bondholders, she thought. The bondholders of the John Galt line. It was to her honor that they had entrusted their money, the saving and achievement of years. It was on her ability that they had staked it. It was on her work that they had relied, and on their own. And she had been made to betray them into a looter's trap. There would be no trains, and no lifeblood of freight. The John Galt line had been only a drain pipe that had permitted Jim Taggart to make a deal and to drain their wealth unearned into his pocket, in exchange for letting others drain his railroad. The bonds of the John Galt line, which this morning had been the proud guardians of their owner's security and future, had become in the space of an hour scraps of paper that no one would buy, with no value, no future, no power, save the power to close the doors and stop the wheels of the last hope of the country. And Taggart Transcontinental was not a living plant, fed by blood it had worked to produce, but a cannibal of the moment, devouring the unborn children of greatness. The tax on Colorado, she thought, the tax collected from Ellis Wyatt to pay for the livelihood of those whose job was to tie him and make him unable to live, those who would stand on guard to see that he got no trains, no tank cars, no pipeline of Reardon metal. Ellis Wyatt, stripped of the right of self-defense, left without voice, without weapons, and worse, made to be the tool of his own destruction, the supporter of his own destroyers, the provider of their food and of their weapons. Ellis Wyatt being choked, with his own bright energy turned against him as the noose. Ellis Wyatt, who had wanted to tap an unlimited source of shale oil, and who spoke of a second renaissance. She sat bent over, her head on her arms, slumped at the ledge of the window, while the great curves of the green-blue rail, the mountains, the valleys, the new towns of Colorado went by in the darkness, unseen. The sudden jolt of brakes on wheels threw her upright. It was an unscheduled stop, and the platform of the small station was crowded with people, all looking off in the same direction. The passengers around her were pressing to the windows, staring. She leaped to her feet, she ran down the aisle, down the steps, into the cold wind sweeping the platform. In the instant before she saw it, and her scream cut the voices of the crowd, she knew that she had known that which she was to see. In a break between mountains, lighting the sky, throwing a glow that swayed on the roofs and walls of the station, the hill of Wyatt Oil was a solid sheet of flame. Later, when they told her that Ellis Wyatt had vanished, leaving nothing behind but a board he had nailed to a post at the foot of the hill, when she looked at his handwriting on the board, she felt as if she had almost known that these would be the words. "I am leaving it as I found it. Take over. It's yours." Part 2. Either Or. Chapter 1. The Man Who Belonged on Earth. Dr. Robert Stadler paced his office, wishing he would not feel the cold. Spring had been late in coming. Beyond the window, the dead gray of the hills looked like the smeared transition from the soiled white of the sky to the leaden black of the river. Once in a while a distant patch of hillside flared into a silver yellow that was almost green, then vanished. The clouds kept cracking for the width of a single sun ray, then oozing closed again. It was not cold in the office, thought Dr. Stadler. It was that view that froze the place. It was not cold today. The chill was in his bones, he thought. The stored accumulation of the winter months, when he had had to be distracted from his work by an awareness of such a matter as inadequate heating, and people had talked about conserving fuel. It was preposterous, he thought, this growing intrusion of the accidents of nature into the affairs of men. It had never mattered before, if a winter happened to be unusually severe. If a flood washed out a section of railroad track, one did not spend 2 weeks eating canned vegetables. If an electric storm struck some power station, an establishment such as the State Science Institute was not left without electricity for 5 days. 5 days of stillness this winter, he thought, with the great laboratory motors stopped and irretrievable hours wiped out, when his staff had been working on problems that involved the heart of the universe. He turned angrily away from the window, but stopped and turned back to it again. He did not want to see the book that lay on his desk. He wished Dr. Ferris would come. He glanced at his watch. Dr. Ferris was late, an astonishing matter, late for an appointment with him. Dr. Floyd Ferris, the valet of science, who had always faced him in a manner that suggested an apology for having but one hat to take off. This was outrageous weather for the month of May, he thought, looking down at the river. It was certainly the weather that made him feel as he did, not the book. He had placed the book in plain view on his desk when he had noted that his reluctance to see it was more than mere revulsion, that it contained the element of an emotion never to be admitted. He told himself that he had risen from his desk, not because the book lay there, but merely because he had wanted to move, feeling cold. He paced the room, trapped between the desk and the window. He would throw that book in the ash can where it belonged, he thought.
just as soon as he had spoken to Dr. Ferris. He watched the patch of green and sunlight on the distant hill, the promise of spring, in a world that looked as if no grass or bud would ever function again. He smiled eagerly, and when the patch vanished, he felt a stab of humiliation at his own eagerness, at the desperate way he had wanted to hold it. It reminded him of that interview with the eminent novelist last winter. The novelist had come from Europe to write an article about him, and he, who had once despised interviews, had talked eagerly, lengthily, too lengthily, seeing a promise of intelligence in the novelist's face, feeling a causeless, desperate need to be understood. The article had come out as a collection of sentences that gave him exorbitant praise and garbled every thought he had expressed. Closing the magazine, he had felt what he was feeling now at the desertion of a sunray. All right, he thought, turning away from the window. He would concede that attacks of loneliness had begun to strike him at times. But it was a loneliness to which he was entitled. It was hunger for the response of some living, thinking mind. He was so tired of all those people, he thought in contemptuous bitterness. He dealt with cosmic rays, while they were unable to deal with an electric storm. He felt the sudden contraction of his mouth, like a slap denying him the right to pursue this course of thought. He was looking at the book on his desk. Its glossy jacket was glaring and new. It had been published 2 weeks ago. "But I had nothing to do with it," he screamed to himself. The scream seemed wasted on a merciless silence. Nothing answered it, no echo of forgiveness. The title on the book's jacket was, "Why Do You Think You Think?" There was no sound in that courtroom silence within him, no pity, no voice of defense. Nothing but the paragraphs which his great memory had reprinted on his brain. Thought is a primitive superstition. Reason is an irrational idea. The childish notion that we are able to think has been mankind's costliest error. What you think is an illusion created by your glands, your emotions, and in the last analysis by the content of your stomach. That gray matter you're so proud of is like a mirror in an amusement park, which transmits to you nothing but distorted signals from a reality forever beyond your grasp. The more certain you feel of your rational conclusions, the more certain you are to be wrong. Your brain being an instrument of distortion, the more active the brain, the greater the distortion. The giants of the intellect, whom you admire so much, once taught you that the earth was flat and that the atom was the smallest particle of matter. The entire history of science is a progression of exploded fallacies, not of achievements. The more we know, the more we learn that we know nothing. Only the crassest ignoramus can still hold to the old-fashioned notion that seeing is believing. That which you see is the first thing to disbelieve. A scientist knows that a stone is not a stone at all. It is, in fact, identical with the feather pillow. Both are only a cloud formation of the same invisible whirling particles. But you say you can't use a stone for a pillow? Well, that merely proves your helplessness in the face of actual reality. The latest scientific discoveries, such as the tremendous achievements of Dr. Robert Stadler, have demonstrated conclusively that our reason is incapable of dealing with the nature of the universe. These discoveries have led scientists to contradictions which are impossible according to the human mind, but which exist in reality nonetheless. If you have not yet heard it, my dear old-fashioned friends, it has now been proved that the rational is the insane. Do not expect consistency. Everything is a contradiction of everything else. Nothing exists but contradictions. Do not look for common sense. To demand sense is the hallmark of nonsense. Nature does not make sense. Nothing makes sense. The only crusaders for sense are the studious type of adolescent old maid who can't find a boyfriend, and the old-fashioned shopkeeper who thinks that the universe is as simple as his neat little inventory and beloved cash register. Let us break the chains of the prejudice called logic. Are we going to be stopped by a syllogism? So you think you're sure of your opinions? You cannot be sure of anything. Are you going to endanger the harmony of your community, your fellowship with your neighbors, your standing, reputation, good name, and financial security, for the sake of an illusion? For the sake of the mirage of thinking that you think? Are you going to run risks and court disasters, at a precarious time like ours, by opposing the existing social order in the name of those imaginary notions of yours which you call your convictions? You say that you're sure you're right? Nobody is right, or ever can be. You feel that the world around you is wrong? You have no means to know it. Everything is wrong in human eyes, so why fight it? Don't argue. Accept. Adjust yourself. Obey. The book was written by Dr. Floyd Ferris and published by the State Science Institute. I had nothing to do with it, said Dr. Robert Stadler. He stood still by the side of his desk with the uncomfortable feeling of having missed some beat of time, of not knowing how long the preceding moment had lasted. He had pronounced the words aloud, in a tone of rancorous sarcasm directed at whoever had made him say it. He shrugged, resting on the belief that self-mockery is an act of virtue. The shrug was the emotional equivalent of the sentence, "You're Robert Stadler. Don't act like a high school neurotic." He sat down at his desk and pushed the book aside with the back of his hand. Dr. Floyd Ferris arrived half an hour late. "Sorry," he said, "but my car broke down again on the way from Washington, and I had a hell of a time trying to find somebody to fix it. There's getting to be so damn few cars out on the road that half the service stations are closed." There was more annoyance than apology in his voice. He sat down without waiting for an invitation to do so. Dr. Floyd Ferris would not have been noticed as particularly handsome in any other profession, but in the one he had chosen he was always described as that good-looking scientist. He was 6 feet tall and 45 years old, but he managed to look taller and younger. He had an air of immaculate grooming and a ballroom grace of motion, but his clothes were severe, his suits being usually black or midnight blue. He had a finely traced mustache, and his smooth black hair made the Institute boys say that he used the same shoe polish on both ends of him. He did not mind repeating, in the tone of a joke on himself, that a movie producer once said he would cast him for the part of a titled European gigolo. He had begun his career as a biologist, but that was forgotten long ago. He was famous as the top coordinator of the State Science Institute. Dr. Stadler glanced at him with astonishment. The lack of apology was unprecedented, and said dryly, "It seems to me that you were spending a great deal of your time in Washington." "But, Dr. Stadler, wasn't it you who once paid me the compliment of calling me the watchdog of this institute?" said Dr. Ferris pleasantly. "Isn't that my most essential duty?" "A few of your duties seem to be accumulating right around this place. Before I forget it, would you mind telling me what's going on here about that oil shortage mess?" He could not understand why Dr. Ferris's face tightened into an injured look. "You will permit me to say that this is unexpected and unwarranted," said Dr. Ferris in that tone of formality which conceals pain and reveals martyrdom. "None of the authorities involved have found cause for criticism. We have just submitted a detailed report on the progress of the work to date to the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, and Mr. Wesley Mooch has expressed himself as satisfied. We have done our best on that project. We have heard no one else describe it as a mess. Considering the difficulties of the terrain, the hazards of the fire, and the fact that it has been only 6 months since we—" "What are you talking about?" asked Dr. Stadler. "The Wyatt Reclamation Project. Isn't that what you asked me?" "No," said Dr. Stadler. "No, I—" "Wait a moment. Let me get this straight. I seem to recall something about this institute taking charge of a reclamation project. What is it that you're reclaiming?" "Oil," said Dr. Ferris. "The Wyatt oil fields." "That was a fire, wasn't it? In Colorado?" "That was..." "Wait a moment. That was the man who set fire to his own oil wells." "I'm inclined to believe that that's a rumor created by public hysteria," said Dr. Ferris dryly. "A rumor with some undesirable, unpatriotic implications. I wouldn't put too much faith in those newspaper stories. Personally, I believe that it was an accident, and that Ellis Wyatt perished in the fire." "Well, who owns those fields now?" "Nobody. At the moment, there being no will or heirs, The government has taken charge of operating the fields as a measure of public necessity for 7 years. If Ellis White does not return within that time, he will be considered officially dead.
Well, why did they come to you, to us, for such an unlikely assignment as oil pumping?
Because it is a problem of great technological difficulty, requiring the services of the best scientific talent available. You see, it is a matter of reconstructing the special method of oil extraction that Wyatt had employed. His equipment is still there, though in a dreadful condition. Some of his processes are known, but somehow there is no full record of the complete operation or the basic principle involved. That is what we have to rediscover.
And how is it going?
The progress is most gratifying. We have just been granted a new and larger appropriation. Mr. Wesley Mooch is pleased with our work. So are Mr. Balch of the Emergency Commission, Mr. Anderson of Crucial Supplies, and Mr. Pettibone of Consumers Protection. I do not see what more could be expected of us. The project is fully successful.
Have you produced any oil?
No, but we have succeeded in forcing a flow from one of the wells to the extent of 6.5 gallons. This, of course, is merely of experimental significance, but you must take into consideration the fact that we had to spend 3 full months just to put out the fire, which has now been totally, almost totally extinguished. We have a much tougher problem than Wyatt ever had, because he started from scratch, while we have to deal with the disfigured wreckage of an act of vicious antisocial sabotage, which, I mean to say, it is a difficult problem, but there is no doubt that we will be able to solve it.
Well, what I really asked you about was the oil shortage here in the Institute. The level of temperature maintained in this building all winter was outrageous. They told me that they had to conserve oil. Surely you could have seen to it that the matter of keeping this place adequately supplied with such things as oil was handled more efficiently.
Oh, is that what you had in mind, Dr. Stadler? Oh, but I am so sorry.
The words came with a bright smile of relief on Dr. Ferris's face. His solicitous manner returned.
Do you mean that the temperature was low enough to cause you discomfort?
I mean that I nearly froze to death.
But that is unforgivable. Why didn't they tell me?
Please accept my personal apology, Dr. Stadler, and rest assured that you will never be inconvenienced again. The only excuse I can offer for our maintenance department is that the shortage of fuel was not due to their negligence. It was...
Oh, I realize that you would not know about it, and such matters should not take up your invaluable attention.
But you see, the oil shortage last winter was a nationwide crisis.
Why?
For heaven's sake, don't tell me that those Wyatt fields were the only source of oil in the country.
No, no.
But the sudden disappearance of a major supply wrought havoc in the entire oil market, so the government had to assume control and impose oil rationing on the country in order to protect the essential enterprises. I did obtain an unusually large quota for the Institute, and only by the special favor of some very special connections. But I feel abjectly guilty if this proved insufficient. Rest assured that it will not happen again. It is only a temporary emergency. By next winter we shall have the Wyatt fields back in production, and conditions will return to normal. Besides, as far as this Institute is concerned, I made all the arrangements to convert our furnaces to coal, and it was to be done next month. Only the Stockton Foundry in Colorado closed down suddenly without notice. They were casting parts for our furnaces. But Andrew Stockton retired quite unexpectedly, and now we have to wait till his nephew reopens the plant.
I see. Well, I trust that you will take care of it among all your other activities.
Dr. Stadler shrugged with annoyance.
It is becoming a little ridiculous, the number of technological ventures that an institution of science has to handle for the government.
But Dr. Stadler...
I know, it can't be avoided. By the way, what is Project X?
Dr. Ferris's eyes shot to him swiftly, an odd, bright glance of alertness that seemed startled but not frightened.
Where did you hear about Project X, Dr. Stadler?
Oh, I heard a couple of your younger boys saying something about it with an air of mystery you'd expect from amateur detectives. They told me it was something very secret.
That's right, Dr. Stadler.
It is an extremely secret research project which the government has entrusted to us, and it is of utmost importance that the newspapers get no word about it.
What's the X?
Xylophone. Project Xylophone. That is a code name, of course. The work has to do with sound. But I'm sure that it would not interest you. It is a purely technological undertaking. Yes, do spare me the story. I have no time for your technological undertakings. May I suggest that it would be advisable to refrain from mentioning the words Project X to anyone, Dr. Stadler? Oh, all right, all right. I must say I do not enjoy discussions of that kind.
But of course, and I wouldn't forgive myself if I allowed your time to be taken up by such concerns. Please feel certain that you may safely leave it to me.
He made a movement to rise.
Now, if this was the reason you wanted to see me, please believe that I...
No, said Dr. Stadler slowly. This was not the reason I wanted to see you.